There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away. So it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Ice fishermen are free, Ed. For 9 months of the year, they're free. It's called open water.
I'd say at least half the stuff I'm making is just going to people decorating cabins or lake houses and things like that.
He recently said that cutthroat were the prettiest, and everybody was like, you need to catch a native brook trout, my friend. Get out of here with that noise. Go find a shed, Mark Kenyon.
Joe, you sweet summer child.
Good morning, degenerate anglers, and welcome to Bent, the fishing podcast that's getting its side hustle on selling mouse pads featuring sunrise and sunset photos we took on our skunk days. I'm Joe Cermelli.
I know that feeling, man. Yeah, and I'm Hayden Samak, and I'm here to tell you that these are exceptional mouse pads. And, you know, kidding aside, as a former hawker of my creative wares, like a $3 mouse pad is one thing, but if you're selling something expensive, right, there is nothing more just blood boiling than when an influencer is like, hey, you know that stuff that you worked like real hard on and is like really like valuable in that way? Yeah, if you give me that for free, I'll shout you out to my 400 followers on Instagram. I hate that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that does happen a lot, right? And look, that's not to say that we don't absolutely love it when we get something sent by a listener. Like we love that. But to actively solicit that sort of thing, it's just kind of lame. And that's another way of saying, for the record, just so you guys know, if you ever see me or Hayden post something from a listener that somebody made, we did not ask for it. You know what I mean? Like, it's cool. We have some cool people out there who are like, hey, yeah, I make this. I'd love for you guys to check this out. And if it's something that we can use or that's cool, we're always happy to do that. And we will shout you out. But we certainly don't seek, you know, makers out and ask for this stuff.
Yeah. Can I have that sweet decoy? We'll get to that later, man. I own a couple decoys and I bought them.
But that said, I can tell you truth from the bottom of my heart. Throughout my entire career, I have always tried to use my platforms, whatever I had going on, whether it was in a magazine story or gear roundup or podcast or whatever, to give exposure to the little guys when I could and when appropriate. I have such a soft spot for people making really good, unique stuff in garages and basements and small operations all over out there. I love that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I think we both like share that similar outlook on the bespoke, if you will. Bespoke, whatever. and as much as like I would like to buy all your cool plugs, rods, flies, and whatever else you make, our seemingly limitless outdoor podcast host money only goes so far. And Joe, I think you see exactly where I'm going with this.
Yeah, you're going to Wendy's tonight because that's what you can afford. No, I see where you're going. And I
only eat elk liver, bro.
I think what you're getting at is we love our sponsors at 13 Fishing, right? Because you got to talk about the big dogs.
We do. That is true. We love our sponsors in 13 Fishing, but that's not where I'm going with this.
No. I'm just kidding. We're going to shout them out a little later, as we always do. But the folks we want to shout out right now are you guys listening, specifically those of you that have combined your creativity and skill with a love of fishing and have found a way to make a business out of it.
That is correct. After a hugely positive response to our, like, should we, shouldn't we question last week, we are starting a new segment called Makers, where we highlight the folks that, you know, make. Now, to be clear, we're not talking about showcasing a cool fly you tied or a picture you painted, although we are very, very proud of you.
Very.
But this Maker segment is really meant to highlight folks who do it at least semi-professionally. So, like, you know, professional
side hustle.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, maybe it's your main gig, but I certainly know a lot of people who are teachers during the day and make some badass rods or whatever at night. So that's who we're talking about. And we thought it would just be a great way to help bring you guys up and get your names out there. And there are so many people deserving of just a little bit of highlighting here. But as promised, let's highlight what's up with 13 Fishing, because that's how the podcast gets made around here.
Yes, indeed. We recently just did a staff ice fishing day out here at Meat Eater, and there were 13 fishing rods. As far as the eye could see, there were 13 fishing rods, to be specific. They sent us, what was it? It was little Kalon reels on, I think, the Widowmaker rods. I can't remember exactly which one they were, but everybody looked cool as hell with them. And I am in love with those Kalon reels, man. They're so smooth. And to be honest with you, I'm just about over ice here, and I'm ready to use the Kalon reels on the open water. And I'm also ready to talk spring and summer with you, Joe, man. What are you looking forward to using the most?
Shad. Well, I got shad on the brain. That is always the first significant thing that, like, really kicks off a fishing season here for me.
Yep.
And I had a chance to use 13's Fate steelhead rods for shad last season. And they are perfect for both casting really tiny darts or back trolling. And, you know, shad have a lot of similarities to steelhead, particularly that they change direction very quickly. So those long whippy rods and that ability to sort of absorb those turns. Steelhead rods traditionally have made great shad rods, but the Fate steelhead are particularly good. But yes, it is warming up here. I'd say 3 weeks-ish. We'll start hearing reports of the first shad around here, and I'll be out there. I have, full disclosure, I have never caught one on my first try of the year because it's generally too early. I'm just so itchy to go. You know, you hear like, oh, there were two caught down here, and you're like, I'm going right now. But it usually takes a week or two. But maybe that trend will be bucked this season. Maybe first time out, I'll get it done.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, man. Well, number one, I used to do the same thing with salmon all the time, like up on.
Yeah, you hear about one, and you're like, "It's on." No, it's not,
dude. I would just start going up at the end of August, man. Just, you know, to hang out and start getting my my sea legs under me, or my salmon river legs, as it were. The other thing, man, is I think I'm going to be on the East Coast a little bit towards the end of April, May. Still be in there? I know that you see them up high.
There's plenty to do if there's not, but the last few seasons, surprisingly, man, I've had great shad fishing almost up to Memorial Day. So late May starts to get a little, but like there's other stuff to do. Late April, that's like primo. Can't be a better time than late April.
My girlfriend and I are planning a turkey hunt East Coast tour, so, you know, I might have to make a little detour. Anyhow, I hope the early season shad works out for you, and I love everything 13 makes, but I happen to know something that they don't make: spearing decoys.
That is a niche market. Right there.
Niche indeed. mostly by local craftsmen.
Yeah. Oh, well,
makers.
We all see where you're going here. So just go ahead and get there already. Let's do it.
All right, folks. So today, in our first ever installment of our Makers series, we're talking to friend of Bent, Ryan Ebert, to hear about his obsession with spearing through the ice and the decoys he makes to do it.
Today, we're doing our tool time salute. Fishing.
It's a real classic. It's handmade bamboo.
Look at this.
Boy, that's a good-looking rod.
Yeah, well, this is handmade quality shit we're talking here.
All right, so joining us today on the Bent Podcast is my Instagram buddy and decoy carver extraordinaire, Wisconsin's favorite son, Ryan Ebert. Now, Joe, before my tenure here on Bent, you and the beloved Mr. Nolte mentioned Ryan on the podcast because he sent you a decoy. And since
he sent me the greatest decoy I've ever gotten.
They're unbelievable. They're unbelievable, and that's why he's guest number one.
Have you gotten your pikelope yet?
I have not gotten a pikelope
because Ryan's still trying to decide if you're as cool as me and Miles.
Well, since that fateful day, I've been a big fan of his. And while I do not have a pikelope, Joe, I do have a cutthroat, and I do have another like working decoy on the way. My girlfriend caught her first perch through the ice, and it was like a big one. So in order to commemorate that, I solicited Mr. Ebert for a replica perch.
Nice. I said to Ryan, have I not said that you could actually just carve fish like in lieu of taxidermy? You're good enough to do that, I think, where that could be another avenue for you. Like, we have to explain that, like, these are not like the like gift shop decoys. Like, your level of detail borders on taxidermy.
I appreciate that. I don't know. An artist is always his worst critic, so I don't know if I'm quite at that level, but
I get that. But I'm telling you, they're good. I sold my pikelope for $2,000 on eBay.
Nice. I think I got a commission coming.
Well, in addition to his decoys, Ryan also does like apparel, and in fact, I own like 5 of his t-shirts, or I used to own 5 of his t-shirts. Realistically, I'm allowed to hang on to one, and my girlfriend, she's stolen the other 4. Actually, dude, this is a total coincidence.
No, it's not. He's rolling up his shirt. You did that on purpose.
Oh, you got the Cuts of Meat shirt on. Yeah, the pikelope.
Yeah. I swear I did not do that on purpose because we scheduled this very last minute. Anyhow, I've been a big fan of his. We have folks at the office who are a big fan of his. Seth and Chester demanded that I get them both pike spearing hoodies. Anyway, dude makes a nice shirt, but that's not really what he's here to talk with us about. Joe?
What?
You want to talk more about the decoys?
I do, yeah. So this is our first Maker's segment, which, by the way, if Maker's Mark is listening, is that not perfect? If Maker's Mark Whiskey would sponsor the Maker's segment here on Bent. But yeah, it only seemed right to kick this off with you, Ryan, because we've just, you know, again, we have some decoys. We've been following each other on the Instagrams. And I think decoys are very interesting, right? Because fair to say that while they certainly have function, because there's a whole culture of people out there that actually use them for spearing, they're one of the weird things that you can make in the fishing realm that also has a whole other life as sort of collectible, right? And also there are people who just make these things that are never meant to get used, unlike yours, that are just like gift shop kitsch. So, you know, I'm curious to talk about like what really separates one from the other. What makes it, is there something that makes a decoy more functional and ready for the hard water than a lot of these things you just see people pump out to put at the gift shop?
Yeah, everything that goes into it, I mean, makes it more functional from the swim, the type of wood, making sure it's properly sealed. Obviously, the price level kind of determines if a guy's putting it down in the water or putting it on the shelf. I'd say at least half the stuff I'm making is just going to collectors or people decorating cabins or lake houses and things like that.
Really? Yeah. Half of what you make, you think, is...
At least.
I mean, I do see a slight there's one similarity, though not quite the same. We see that a lot in striper lures, the guys turning that stuff out here. Mm. Not so much for decor, but I would say 50%, if not more in some cases, are bought to hold on to. Like, they're never going to see water. So, I mean, obviously it doesn't bother you is the wrong word because you're making money, but I assume you would prefer to see your decoys actually used on the ice.
Yeah, I mean, every single decoy I make, even if I know it's like ultra decorative and probably never going to see the water, I'm still making it the same way. I'm using cedar, I'm sealing it and priming it and using spar urethane to clear coat it and making it to swim, even though I know it's probably not going to go in the water. I'm still doing the same process regardless.
Well, contributing to that 50% statistic, 50% of the Ryan Ebert decoys that I own or am soon to own are indeed decorative. I had to make a cutthroat decoy that's just like wonderful, and that sits proudly on my mantle.
Before totally, and I'm not knocking that. I just want to make sure, they are art, right? I'm not saying it's weird to have one for decoration. My Pycalope is decoration. But before we go on, though, I do think we should explain, just in case you're not familiar with pike spearing decoys. Ryan, just give us the quick version of what these things actually do. Why do you need this?
So, yeah, here in Wisconsin, our big thing is sturgeon spearing because we don't really have pike spearing here. But Michigan, Minnesota, North Dakota, a whole bunch of ice belt states all have pike spearing. So in the winter months, go out, take a dark house, whether it's a permanent shack or a pop-up shack. You cut a big-ass hole in the ice, usually 3 feet by 4 feet. And then the decoy is your primary attractant for pike. You know, they're just, as you guys know, they're just ultra-aggressive predators. They're generally coming in and either eyeing it up or they're smacking that decoy and biting, chomping down on it. And then you're sitting above with a spear and that's how you get them.
One question that I have is, how did you get into making these decoys? Like, what was the genesis of Ryan Ebert decoy production here?
So about 15 years ago, I got into pike spearing through a good buddy I went to college with. We both went for graphic design, so that's where the kind of the apparel design comes in. His dad was a warden up in Marinette County, Wisconsin, and he was really big into pike spearing and carving decoys, and went up and the very first outing, we didn't even see a pike or didn't have any luck. But I was just hooked. You know, it's so different. It's more like probably bow hunting than it is fishing. Like, you're picking a spot. I mean, you're not bouncing around like with tip ups or anything. You're not covering a big part of the lake. It's like duck hunting out a chimney. I mean, you got one little area that you're watching and you're hoping they come in and you're just waiting, and it can be boring for hours on end, but then all of a sudden that 5 seconds of a monster pike or any fish coming through, you know, it gets the heart pumping, and there's no guarantee of connecting either. It's not as easy as some guys think. You know, you're not just slaying them.
So in a similarity to lures, right, to lure making, like, what's, in basic terms, what separates, in your opinion, an okay decoy from a great decoy? Because, you know, there's, to use swim baits as an example, there's $500 swim baits, there's $3 swim baits. They're all in one classification of doing the same thing. And, you know, like, there are people who argue me in some cases with predator fish that if he's hungry and interested, like, he's going to eat the $5 swim bait or he's going to eat the $500 swim bait. But yet I still recognize that in terms of action and what they do, there are obviously nuances. So what in your opinion should a decoy do to make it more potent or more attractive than a lesser decoy? What's the difference?
The primary thing is swim. It should move forward in the water and make a nice slow circle. There are actually contests and classes and shows that have contests just for that, on how the decoy swims in the water. So they'll swim it in a 6-foot tank and judge it all upon that. From a collector's standpoint, it's all about the name. So certain carvers, you know, develop a name or a following, and then that really ups the value of those decoys.
Yeah, we did a news story a while ago that somebody unearthed a collection that they had authenticated that, I mean, they were selling at Sotheby's or something like that. I mean, crazy amounts of money for some of the really old, unique stuff, right?
Yeah, I think that was a Peterson decoy, if I remember correctly. Yeah, so
something like that,
carvers that have passed on, and, you know, that's a limited supply of decoys. They're not obviously anymore being added out there, and they get pretty valuable.
So if you go into a tackle shop in Wisconsin or wherever spearing happens, are there also sort of stock mass-produced decoys that you would just find next to everything else on the shelves in there?
There's some. I mean, yeah, there's some commercial manufacturers. Here in Wisconsin, we don't have Pike Spirits, so you got to pretty much go up to Lake Winnebago and go to any bars or gas stations around there, and you'll see them hanging in there, especially this time of year. The season just wrapped up yesterday, so you'll see guys that make them all around the lake. And for sturgeon spearing, they don't care as much about the swim. They're just doing generally larger, brighter, colorful decoys.
Sure.
Now, I know that a lot of these decoys, you know, typically run like, you know, $50 to $150, you know, if you're
trying
to get
something like
really nice. That's for
a worker decoy is like that range. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I do know an extremely effective decoy that you can buy for 99 cents, and it comes with it comes full of coffee. I sent
What?
Yeah, I sent Chester Floyd sturgeon spearing with a friend of yours.
John Mertz.
John Mertz, right.
He's out of Minnesota. Misfits
decoy. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
I sent Chester up with a John Mertz decoy, and he wanted to use it, but the hot thing on the lake happened to be styrofoam coffee cups. Ryan,
it's probably not styrofoam. It's probably ceramic. Yeah, like a regular coffee mug. Yeah, sturgeon guys will throw anything down from disco balls to Barbie cars. I watched a dude put two duck decoy, or I think they're geese decoys, like back to back, wrapped around. I mean, they'll just throw anything because sturgeon are big, curious dinosaurs. So you're just trying to throw stuff at them that they haven't seen before. So they're not always swimming traditional decoys on bagel.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
But the pike, because it's more of a predatory response, you want those decoys to swim in a very particular way, and you want them to be representative of something a pike might have a predatory reaction to.
Yeah, yeah. Generally, you want them to swim better, but even those, you want to mix it swim styles, ones that are fast or slow. I make some that are called like wiggle decoys that are finless, and they kind of act like they're dying. The eyelet's on the bottom of the belly, so when you jig it, it kind of does like a belly flip, like a dying shad. Yeah. Kinda. Oh. Yeah.
Kind of like a big old like flutter spoon.
Yeah. 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 Especially on a slower day, you're just kind of throwing different stuff at them until you see what really gets them going.
So perhaps a dumb question, right? Because I certainly do understand the culture behind this. In fact, I've always wanted to...
There are only dumb questions on the Bent podcast.
Yeah, I've always wanted to try pike spearing, right? I've never gotten a chance to do that.
You guys got an open invite.
Yeah, I should take you up on that.
We're going next
year, Joe. Yeah, well, I've been wanting to do that for a while. But anyway, does anybody ever, I don't know, use like a live sucker as a decoy with a couple treble hooks in it? Or maybe put some treble hooks on their decoy?
Yeah.
Just in case?
Every state has different, obviously, regulations. So you can put what's called, a cheater hook on a traditional decoy. Mm-hmm. And there are guys, especially in Minnesota, they like to run a live sucker. And usually a regular decoy, they'll run two down. Again, anything just to see what's getting them going that particular day.
Gotcha.
For sturgeon spearing, you can't run anything with a hook, and I don't think you can use live bait at all.
Right. Well, we have a couple questions. I think we're aiming to sort of do this for all of our makers segments, because I think they work. But the first one would be, who was your inspiration? Like, who did you learn from? Who was the biggest inspiration for your work?
Yeah, it's my buddy's dad that got me into it. He's a retired warden now. He definitely got me into the whole pike spearing, and I picked his brain starting out, you know, on making decoys. And like I said, there's shows that I go to, and I've met other carvers and just, you know, gotten tips from everybody. And everybody's got such unique styles. And
is there a particular carver that you go, I would like to... maybe not make something identical to that, but I'm using this dude's process more than others as a particular influence?
Not any particular one. There's definitely parts of my process that I can credit to different guys that have told me how to cut fins better or do like the gill details better.
So it's more of a technical influence than an artistic influence.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I definitely don't try to like copy anybody's style, or if they do a particular thing that they're known for,
the Bass Pro Shops of the carving world is what you're saying.
No.
Right.
Next question that we have for you, man, is have you ever in your pursuit of pike decoy perfection Have you ever like done an experiment that was just a total and complete disastrous like failure, like something that except in this context you wouldn't want anybody to know about? Share that with 15,000 people real quick.
Utter failures? No, but I've had stuff that's really just made me pull my hair out. When I make the full-size pikelope, man, those antlers really mess up my whole wading process and getting it to swim, and I'll spend hours on one decoy, on one full-size pikelope, getting it to swim. Paddlefish is the same thing because they got that real long, you know, nose on them, so that really makes the balancing of it super tricky. So,
but you've just brought up something interesting. So even if I'm commissioning you to make a decoy that's going to be purely for decoration purposes, and you know that, you are still making sure that thing swims if I wanted it to.
Absolutely, because if it doesn't swim, if I'm not making it correctly, it's not a fish decoy.
That's what separates. That's what levels you up right there. Is even if it's a decoration, it would perform if you needed it to.
Yeah, and I've done some like fish plaques, you know, mounting on wood. So that's purely decoration, and that's a totally different thing. But yeah, if it's a fish decoy, I'm making it to swim. Like I said, my whole process is the same either way, even if I know it's just going on a shelf.
You hear that, folks, man? When you're buying a Brian Ebert decoy, you're not only getting an artistic representation, you're getting dedication to craft.
Anyway,
well, thank you so much for like coming and talking to us, man. Do you want to tell our listeners where they can find you, on social media, and then if they would like to buy something from you, where they might find you as well?
Yeah, primarily my Instagram is where I'm sharing all my fish decoys and spear and apparel. So that's Ryan Ebert Art. Etsy is what I sell most of my stuff through, which is also Ryan Ebert Art. I'm also on the board of directors for the National Fish Decoy Association, and we have a show in Pura, Minnesota. Oh. That's April 22nd, I think, that weekend. So if guys want to meet me in person, you can come to that show, and I'll have lots of decoys there. Pretty much everything I'm making right now, I'm kind of holding and setting aside for that show. So there's not much on my Etsy shop available right now.
Right on, man. Well, we kicked it off with ice decoys. The possibilities are endless, Hayden. Lure makers, rod makers. Who will be next on Makers?
Well, I'll tell you what. If you think that you are the next maker,
send us what you make. We will assess it and then decide.
No. email us at bent@themeateater.com with a little bit of paragraph about you and an example of your art, and hopefully you get to be on the show soon. What do you think, Joe? Is that an appropriate plug there?
Very appropriate.
All right, thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dude, so cool. I love that, man.
Yeah, Ryan's stuff is truly outstanding. You should all check him out if you haven't already. And while the ice is dwindling, I would say, in my region, I know a lot of you still have good ice, and maybe you're not into spearing, but just hate the fact that, you know, ice fishing just allows you to kind of drop a bait or jig straight down.
Yeah, I cannot stand that.
Isn't it horrible? You just feel like, man, if this water were just open, I could cast anywhere I wanted to.
trolling thing, man.
Don't ruin it, because we've got a sale bin item today that can help you out if you just hate the fact that ice fishing is kind of a straight up and down thing. And this should be fun, because I already know Hayden and I have different opinions about this item.
Well, why did you put the ad in the paper if you don't know what I'm getting at?
Well, you didn't have to be so hurtful with me, so angry.
This sale bin entry comes to us from listener Isaac Lintz, and it's a weird one because he said he saw this on Facebook Marketplace, but he didn't supply a link to the item. And I went on Facebook Marketplace and searched it. I looked for it myself, and I couldn't find it. But what Isaac told us was that after seeing it for sale somewhere out there on the interwebs, he ended up wanting to dig deeper. And he looked this product up, and he found it on YouTube, two videos. And that's what he sent, was these two links to these videos. And the product is called the Bait Transporter.
Yeah. And now, before we start picking this apart, let's just like describe this item in the simplest terms.
Yes.
The Bait Transporter, it's like a flat wooden, like, kind of like planer board almost, with like a point at one end, and below it is a motor, and dangling from that is a downrigger release clip. 50 feet of cord are connected to the motor, and what you do is you attach your fishing line to the release clip, slip the bait transporter under the ice, power it up, and off it goes, carrying whatever lure or bait you've connected 50 feet from the hole you drilled. And once it gets to the end of the cord, it turns and will continuously run in a 50-foot circle around your hole.
Right. Now, neither of these videos made it clear, to me at least, if the idea is to take a bait out, right, and then you snap the line out of the release clip and your bait falls, or you effectively troll a spoon or a crankbait or whatever under the ice. That's how they're showing it in action. They show this thing pulling a spoon behind it. My guess is that it will do both, but I have issues with both of those objectives separately, which we'll get into in just a little bit here.
Yeah, so now that we have a full understanding of what this product is, let's discuss who's selling it. His name is Ed Smith.
I'm out here on Lake Superior today. It's a beautiful day. We're just off a little rainbow stream. I have this new sport fishing device that I'm going to be using today. It's something I invented. It's called a bait transporter.
In case you're wondering, yes, all the music in Ed's videos sounds like what was playing when the baby whale is finally born in Blue Planet. I'm pretty sure it's also like the stock music that they... My brother has a drone and he makes these drone videos, and I think that's the same stock music that they give him to make the videos with.
It's very strange.
Ed seems like a good salt of the earth dude. But he's also the kind of guy, and I think we all know or know one, that's like a basement tinkerer.
Yes.
Ed is a mad scientist, an engineer of sorts. But whereas some folks spend lots of money prototyping, it looks like Ed built his prototype for whatever he already had laying around the garage.
Yeah.
Much like some prototypes I developed in high school.
Yeah. So the name, even the name bait transporter, is crudely burned into the wood plank.
I love that touch.
But it tapers at the end. It's like he ran out of room. Like, you know when you're writing some long shit and you're like, oh, I don't have enough room for the E and the R. So, like, bait transporter shrinks away. And, like, there's barely enough room on there. Now, underneath, the motor that moves this device, that provides the thrust, it's just a small fish tank water pump, right? So, basically, it's got, like, a little jet drive going on. And the cord is 50 feet of that thick, clear cord where you can see all the copper wiring inside, right? And then every few feet, Ed put foam bobbers on the cord, strung bobbers on the cord to ensure that the cord would float underneath the ice instead of sinking away. And all of this glory and power is run by a car battery that he has out on the ice with him.
Yes. And now, like, the case that Ed makes in his video is that despite all the electronics available these modern days, modern ice fishermen still fish like cavemen, meaning like they can only drop a lure in like a 1 foot area, I guess, on like the lake. So I'll let Ed explain what that means.
This is a picture I drew of the very first ice fisherman. Yep, he's a caveman. Now over here, I have a picture of today's fisherman. He's got a camp, and he's got a four-wheel drive truck and a trailer and ice huts with televisions and stereos. He's got ice tents. He's got fish finders and underwater televisions. He's got snow machines. If you look here, you'll notice that he is doing the same thing as this guy over here. So that means since the beginning of time, ice fishing has never changed.
So if you watch this video, he actually draws a caveman fishing and then compares it to another drawing of modern ice fishing. And they're like something my kids would have drawn.
It's a very potent piece of rhetoric.
It's very funny. It's very funny. Now, Ed claims that with his device, right, you can fish anywhere within 7,000 square feet of the hole. And his tagline, his tagline, is that this device sets ice fishermen free. Now, listen, Ed, I do appreciate the thought process and the work that went into this. And I'm not saying that there's no ingenuity here, right? It does steer itself in a circle and all that. I mean, there was some thought put into this. But my gut reaction to the idea of this freeing of the ice fishermen, even before I get into the logistics, are that ice fishermen are free, Ed. For 9 months of the year, they're free. It's called open water. I see what he's trying to do here. But isn't part of the skill and fun of ice fishing about being able to, you know, first off, go wherever you want on the lake on foot, not needing a boat, and then, you know, finding the perfect spot to drill a hole, and you're hoping that you're sitting right on top of the fish. Like, that's just kind of what ice fishing is to me. So this kind of changes the game, and I don't know if it's positively, but you ice fish more than I do, so I want to hear your thoughts.
Joe, you sweet summer child. Man, I think it's okay. So, is Ed's invention a little hokey? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there are things that I like about it, and some of the things that I like about it would be what you might consider a critique of it, except you got to think about it the right way. So, that copper line is like really good, because my initial thought was like, well, why don't you just take like a remote control, like I'm sure they have some remote control submarine or like, you know, whatever, and just like, you know, zip it around underneath the ice with like a crankbait attached to it. And then I realized that steering it back to the hole blindly would be really difficult. So like plus one for the giant copper cord. Two, my next critique was, man, isn't that like a lot of stuff, like a car battery? Isn't that like a lot of stuff to like bring out? And then I thought about it for 3 seconds. I was like, bro, you camp on the ice all the damn time. The amount of crap that you bring out there with you, like, you wouldn't even notice the car battery. So I like that. Mm. Or it's not that I like that. It's just like it's a non-issue. It's a moot point. My other kind of critique is this is basically the ice fishing equivalent, or I guess the terminal tackle equivalent of like side scanner compared to your like drop down the hole transducer. You know what I mean? Like you're basically... as a side scanner amplifies your visible area or radar area, the what the hell does he call this thing?
Bait transporter.
Yeah, the bait transporter increases your fishable area in a very similar way. Now, here are some actual critiques that I have over it. Like number one, Ed, golly man, make the thing look better. Just put some more time into like presentation, man. It's fine. Just spray paint the whole thing and just start over with a nice graphic, man. That'll get you so much further immediately. Next thing I have like a problem with is I'm not sure how fish would react to this underwater from the standpoint that everything's like kind of lethargic. I don't know exactly how fast this goes, but I wonder how effective like In a type of fishing that demands such a subtle presentation, how effective that like trolling at whatever speed might be.
Mm-hmm.
So, but,
wait.
Yeah.
If Ed were to show up and give you this, would you run out on the ice and give her a go? Would you use this product?
Would I use this product?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if somebody out of the kindness of their hearts is going to send me a bait transporter, I would indeed give it a shot. Would I bring it every time? No. But one thing that I immediately kind of thought of was it might be kind of effective to find like kokanee, because they're like attracted to like big, shiny, like fluttering things. And I thought that you might have some utility there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like, do I want to go fish with it? No, not really, man. I will be honest with you, not really. But mark my words, I'm going to call it now. Inside of 10 years, there will be a product very similar to Ed's bait transporter, and it will be widely used by ice fishermen. And I think that it will be widely used in combination with the side scan sonar. So there you go.
Okay.
Those are my thoughts on it.
Yeah. All right. So let me crack my neck and crack my knuckles before I begin here. So.
Oh, God. Wait. That's no fair, man. I didn't know you were going to make me do it all at once, and then you were going to, like, roll a rebuttal at me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what I was doing. That's I wanted to hear your thoughts first.
It is not in the notes that is how this was going to work out. I thought I was just offering my thoughts and like.
Well, you ice fish more than I do, so I'm going to bring up some practical things.
No, that was great, man. Walk me into it blind. Great.
All right. So for starters, right, the bait transporter has a GoPro attachment on it, facing backwards, which tells me that the intention is to troll with it, because why would you need a GoPro if you're not expecting a fish to eat behind it? The first thing that came to mind for me was the sound. This has got to be making all kinds of sound underwater, and you're dragging this cord around. Is that attractive to fish? But more so, unless you're targeting, like you brought up, kokanee or even trout.
What if it turns out to be like pelagic fishing boats, where like some of them are tuned in frequencies that like the fish end up liking, and some of them are just like dead, so you have these like bait transporters?
I'm not saying it'll never work, but
this one sounds really good. This one doesn't work.
Well, what I'm saying is, if you think about depth, so if you're going to pull a spoon or a jig or crankbait or whatever, well, that's great if the fish you're trying to target are swimming 1 to 3 feet under the ice. As soon as you increase the depth of the lure, like the deeper you try to send it, the less action it's going to have with that thing moving in a wide circle. Like even though that's moving around, the deeper you go, the less that's going to translate to the action that the lure is supposed to have. So I don't really fully understand how that would work.
You know what would be kind of cool to do with it? Would be like if you had a side scan, right? And a lot of this argument is contingent on you having a side scan. But it would be interesting to like drive around, get it over where you think the fish are, and then just like dead stick it.
Well, okay. I thought of that too. So let's say you legitimately use this thing to place a bait or something, and you keep consistently getting bit at the 11 o'clock hour on your turn, 50 feet away from your hole.
Wouldn't I just pick up my shit
and go drill a hole over there? Instead of dealing with wires and cables and stuff?
I mean, that could be a good way to find it, because I'll tell you what, in the time that it would take you to drill, like, those 60 holes to encompass, like, a 50-foot, 60 or 360-degree radius, you could just do that in one turn with the handy bait transporter.
Okay. Now, here's another thing. Let's say...
Then go set up on them.
Let's say the bait transporter does its job, and, like, a 20-pound pike comes over and grabs whatever you're pulling. You're going to fight that fish through a tiny hole with a tiny rod while you're also dealing with 50 feet of cable and a moving object in the same hole? Like, dude, how often have you gotten tangled just in your transducer that's bobbing right there? So I don't see how that doesn't equate to mad tangles, dude.
Here's my argument there, man. I would say that, like, the one wire that is going down the hole and immediately banking 90 degrees is less in the way than my like heavy transducer that's like hanging down 3 feet below like what I'm fishing.
Okay. And my last thing was, if you're going to use this for bait delivery, like to drop a dead bait further away from you or something, it doesn't move particularly fast. So is it really more efficient to keep pulling this thing in by hand, dragging all the cord in, setting the release clips, sending it back out, and it goes along real slow? Like, is that more efficient than just drilling more holes in the area to find the fish? I think if it was just
going out and doing one, I would agree with you. I'd be like, yeah, you got to send this thing under. It goes out 50 yards, you know, or 50 feet or whatever it is. But because it's like running that circle, I would say that, yeah, that is more efficient. I would say definitely takes less time.
Well, the only thing I will say, I don't agree that this is going to be the next big thing, right? And it's not going to be like side scan, because side scan lets you see to the side, which would allow you to move your hole based just on what's on your screen from side scan. But I do think if there was something here, like, you know, we got to get to the Tesla, and Ed just built the Ford Model A. You know what I mean? Like, years and years and years down the line, maybe there's something here that, you know, acts like a drone that goes one way and then just automatically comes home. I don't know, but I think to make that technology really efficient, it would be a really expensive item, and I don't think your average ice fisherman is going to go for that. I think he's going to go out, hand auger his holes, jig up his perch, drink some beers, and go home. I don't see it, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Well, the precedent for ice fishing being expensive has already been set. You know, our buddy Jay Siemens out there with those snow bear things.
Mm-hmm.
Dropping down like the $6,000 side scan total setup.
But that's not the average person, dude. That's not your average guy. And for something to make it, I think, yeah, well, in the market, has to be affordable, and a lot of people have to want it, right? Like, that's not, well, you know
who else is not the average guy? Our buddy Ed.
Well, now Ed's getting after it. I give a lot of credit to Ed. It's not Ed, but you know, he's created something here that I felt was worth debate. Also, we know of it because of Isaac. So, Isaac, thank you so much for sending this.
Thanks, Isaac.
Yes, this was a really fun one. We'll put a clip of this product in our Instagram stories today so you guys can check it out. And if you find something fish or fishing related on your favorite online classified that's just ridiculous, please keep sending those links. Send that link to bent@themeateater.com. Do please write in or hit us up and let us know what you think of the bait transporter. I'd be really curious to hear if you guys think it's a great idea or not. Again, I'm not trying to take anything away from this guy, but come on. Okay, it's a lot going on. It's a lot happening.
I think you're going to hear that it's genius. Also, if you'd like to hear what a winning news report sounds like, stay tuned as I crush Joe in this week's installment of Fish News.
Fish News!
That escalated quickly.
Hey, real quick, just because I forgot to mention it last week, as trout season openers approach, some of you guys that have procreated and produced smaller versions of yourself may be interested in a piece I recently published on the Meat Eater site about taking your little people trout fishing and how to help craft them into better trout anglers specifically. It was actually a very fun one to write. So that's on the Meat Eater site if that does something for you.
Yeah, I feel like at Meat Eater, we've been putting out a lot of, like, the child-related content. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole book. Steve's got a whole book coming out, so very much so lately. And it's a very fun thing to write about if you have the kids. Anyway, last week we mentioned that we'd kick off a little thing in news here called Conservation Minutes at the front of news each week.
Mm-hmm.
As a recap, we're doing that just because, you know, we have limited time here every week with the news, and it's hard to cover everything, you know?
Yeah, so we just want to keep you, like, kind of posted on what's going on, even if we don't have time to, like, dive into it long term. You know, it'd be, like, fun, man, would be a... like, eventually we could do, like, a daily show thing with, like, an auxiliary correspondent, like a reporter or something like that.
Maybe, down the line.
I thought that'd be funny. Anyway, so, Joe, you're doing the minutes this week. Let's hear what you got.
Yeah, a couple things real quick here. So, for the first time since 1990, Florida anglers may be able to take a Goliath grouper home for dinner. A vote will be made by Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission this week on the final version of fishing regulations for Goliath grouper that was drafted and initially approved in October. We covered that story back then, talking about how many anglers say, hey, look, there's plenty of them out there, so let's do this. And then the scuba industry is saying, yes, but leave them alone because our clients like to look at them. The rules feature a highly regulated, limited harvest of these fish, which can grow over 600 pounds and 8 feet in length.
That's a lot of grouper, man.
That's a lot of meat, man. If you're going to kill one, how about a 20-pounder? 600 pounds, that's a bit. One other thing here. So Bass Pro Shops owner Johnny Morris is reviving the World's Fair of Fishing in Springfield, Missouri this spring. The event will showcase 200 exhibitors representing over 150 manufacturers across boating, fishing, and outdoor gear. There will be more than 500,000 square feet of merchandise, much of it on sale at reduced prices, from boats to rods to clothing. Now, the event expects to bring upwards of 300,000 people in over the course of 5 days, especially with added incentive, though not for me, from acts like Dirks Bentley, Luke Bryan, and Hank Williams Jr. Hank Williams Jr., I'd watch him.
Oh, yeah.
I got cursed out by him once. I've brought that up before. Long story. Anyway, yes. We don't have time for that right now, okay. But he called me an MRF-er and kicked me off his property. Anyway, I brought up that story because Morris, who's a big-time conservationist, has earmarked 50% of the proceeds from all of that, both admissions to the fair and concert tickets, for outdoor conservation. So if you're in that neck of the woods and going to that, you are giving back a little bit with that one.
There you go. Okay. Conservation minutes, man. You know, I hate to make you talk so much. And we got
I don't mind.
I know you don't mind. We got to figure it out a little bit better. Maybe whoever's lead it is, the other person reads the conservation minutes. But all that said, Joe, it is your lead today, so you're going to have to keep talking. What do you got for us in this week's fish news?
Yeah, don't forget the mighty Phil, our audio engineer, is going to judge this. I don't think Phil should consider conservation minutes. I think the battle still has to rage on main stories. And listen, ironically, like we said with conservation minutes, it's not to say we won't cover bigger stories where appropriate, and I actually have one that's very conservation bent this week.
As
so a few listeners sent this along, and I appreciate it very much. It comes from the website biographic.com. And it covers an initiative to get rid of brook trout in New Mexico. Brook trout are found throughout the American West, including in the Rockies, Sierra Nevada, and Cascades. But what some people may not realize is that they are actually invasive there. Now, if you live east of the Mississippi, you know, especially if you grew up in the Northeast where Hayden and I did, this may come as a surprise because brook trout, wild and native ones especially, are kind of a big deal out here.
Oh yeah,
like they're the state fish of Pennsylvania and New Jersey.
We were talking earlier, man. Those are like my favorite things to fish for.
Yeah. Oh yeah, big deal here, and they are arguably the most beautiful trout species.
It's hard to argue against it.
Well, I know. Although Mark Kenyon just recently did from over there.
Mark Kenyon's caught like six fish, man. All of them are on Instagram.
Listening. I hope he's listening. He recently said that cutthroat were the prettiest, and everybody was like, "You need to catch
a native brook trout, Mark."
So I was going to say, get out of here with that noise. Go find a shed, Mark Kenyon. Anyway, brookies are so intertwined with Eastern culture and prize that it can be hard to imagine them being highly unwanted and actually a real pain in the ass elsewhere. According to the story, which provides a fascinating history lesson, just so we understand what's going on, the Mississippi River, that's the natural barrier that stopped those fish from getting west, from migrating naturally. And they theoretically could have through the Mississippi, but it's just too warm. So that was like the natural barricade, which means every brook trout west of the Mississippi was planted, and planting was rampant during the era.
Hold on. I'm sorry. I'm very interested in your news story. In the wintertime, like a brook trout couldn't just grease across the Mississippi?
I mean, it could, but if you think of where a lot of these wild and native brook trout are in comparison to the Mississippi, I mean, you'd be talking about fish swimming from the headwaters in North Carolina and West Virginia and wherever.
Oh.
All the way down to the big water, all the way to the Ohio River or whatever, all the way through the Ohio to the Mississippi.
You know what? I had like a totally like childlike conceptualization of what you were talking about.
No, what
I imagine
what I'm saying
this, like,
is
little cold water estuary going right down to the edge of the Mississippi, and another cold water estuary just right on the other side, and a brook trout is going.
No.
Sorry,
that's why I'm saying it's theoretically possible for them to do that.
Right. Okay.
But
last time I interrupted your story. Sorry. Continue.
No. I mean, plus you got to consider predation. Like, if you're a 6-inch brookie swimming through the Mississippi, something's fucking eating you. You know what I mean? Anyway, planting was rampant during the era when European settlers were arriving in the U.S. in droves, and as they migrated west, you know, they don't know what kind of fish they might find out there. They thought it would be a good idea to take brookies along. They like trout. They know trout. And then as the rail system developed, they had special fish cars that were designed just for this transport. And along the route, they would just stop at trackside lakes and rivers and either offload the fish with trucks or just fill milk cans and run them down and dump them. It's a really interesting story. It said during this time, during the late 19th century, what was referred to as acclimatization was in vogue, and it means that people back then wrongly believed that introducing a species improved ecological conditions.
Here's a quote
from
building up like a menagerie.
Like we're going to make that better, right? And it's a great quote from the story. It says, as author Kim Todd writes in Tinkering with Eden, ponds and lakes, rather than being viewed as complex ecosystems, were treated as outdoor aquariums waiting to be filled. And it says, even the Sierra Club, which now campaigns against invasive species, was involved back then, transplanting large numbers of brook trout and other trout into lakes and streams along its guided routes through the High Sierra so that paying customers could have an authentic wilderness experience. So bottom line, as pretty as wild brookies are, they're also pretty voracious, and they outcompete native species for food and habitat, which brings us back to this current eradication effort. Graduate students from the Department of Wildlife and Conservation Ecology have been shocking Leandro Creek in New Mexico in an effort to compare brook trout numbers to native Rio Grande cutthroats, which are one of the most maligned trout species in the country. Today, the Rio Grandes are found in only 10% of their historic native range. And brookies and Rio Grande cutthroats are the only trout that live in this tiny stream. And the team was seeing 5 brookies for every 1 cuddy when they shocked. However,
that's not shocking.
Yeah, exactly. Right now, however, most of the brook trout, good one.
Thanks.
Most of the brook trout the team captures, they are males. And that's because Leandro is the host of an ongoing experiment using Trojan trout.
Is that a trout condom?
No, I think it's playing off the Trojan horse.
No, I get but, it. But when you're talking about breeding and you label
although
something
there's a horse
Trojan
on Trojan condoms too, you know, pocket full of Trojans. Wait, I think Prince said,
is that where Trojan condoms?
You can research that on your own time.
Okay,
I'm going to keep going on here. So what is a Trojan trout? A Trojan trout is a lab produced brookie. That they are made to carry not one, but 2 copies of Y chromosomes that codes maleness. So they have no X chromosome to pass on. So to break that down, these lab-made Trojan brookies, they can spawn with the wild female brook trout in the stream, but they'll never pass on the chromosomes to create more female brook trout.
This sounds like it's going to work.
Well, maybe. So the program has been going on since 2018. These Trojan brook trout have been implanted in several streams across the Vermejo Reserve. However, this actually all started way back in 2008 when fisheries biologist Dan Schill came up with this idea and started making brookies at a hatchery in Idaho, I believe it was. Now, you said this is going to work. This hasn't been in practice long enough to determine if it will. But just to give you an idea, the New Mexico streams first had these Trojan brookies implanted in 2018. By the end of the second spawning season in 2020, 75% of the fish captured in Leandro Creek were male. And also 30% of the juveniles captured from test streams in the area were the male offspring of the YY Trojan brook trout. So the idea, right, is that this will eventually cause the brookie populations to just burn out because there won't be any females. So you say, will it work? I mean, here's the thing. While this process takes much longer, it's like a long game deal, it could definitely be a better alternative to dealing with invasives with things like rotenone, right? A chemical, they've used that in Maine as an example to rid certain systems of smallmouth. The problem with chemically treating, of course, is that you risk killing the fish you're trying to save to get rid of the ones you don't.
Yeah, but all good things take time, man. I'm actually, this story was on the periphery. I thought about taking this one. I didn't read all the way through it, but this is one of the first conservation solutions of this ilk where I've heard and been oh, that actually sounds pretty tenable.
So it makes perfect sense. It's just how long does it take to play out? And here's a final note, and you're going to find this interesting because I was blown away by this right here. It turns out that east of the Mississippi, several states, including Tennessee and North Carolina, are also very interested in Trojan trout, ironically, to save their native brookies, which are being overtaken in many watersheds by non-native rainbow trout. So we've stocked so many rainbows on the East Coast that they are actually breeding strongly enough in certain areas that little wild rainbows are overtaking our prized native brookies. So these states want these labs and hatcheries to start creating Trojan YY rainbows for us to put in these mountain trickles in North Carolina and West Virginia and stuff. to get rid of the rainbows.
Yeah, I'm genuinely excited about this, man. You hear this like kind of story played out with like early, you know, I'm using quotes, wildlife management, you know, particularly like I was talking with somebody about this the other day, like wildlife diplomacy. Like, like Roosevelt dropped all those elk down in New Zealand. You know what I mean? It's weird that coinciding with the ease of international travel, a lot of folks were like, you know what? You know, it's going to be a great like gift to give to this country that I'm hoping to build relations with, an invasive species.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think this is a really fascinating approach. The thing is, if you're looking at it on this very small scale, these small streams, these headwaters in the east and these small streams, I mean, they're doing this in streams you could jump across, right? You know, like your Pennsylvania blue line type of streams. But like, is this translatable to Asian carp?
Yeah.
To snakeheads? Would it eventually, I mean, now you're, once you jump into these big systems where you're trying to eradicate something in this huge watershed versus seeing how it works just in this one stream first, you know, is that viable? But I think it's a very noteworthy and cool study. I love the idea of it. I really do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like a good way to like manage these really delicate ecosystems that are these blue lines and these like headwaters. And I remember, you know, now on the East Coast, one thing that we don't often do is, you know, it's not like out here in Montana where like all the fish you're fishing for are wild. You know, the on the East Coast, one of the, I mean, I never killed wild fish on the East Coast.
No,
never.
No.
But one of the few wild fish that I did kill was in a particularly good brook trout blue line that will remain nameless. I had fished it a couple times and, you know, it was one of those spots, and I've told you about this place, you fish it like twice, three times, you know, a spring or summer, and otherwise you try and keep the pressure on it, off it rather, but you could do like, you know, a bunch of like, I mean, you could catch all the brook trout you wanted out of there and just have a ball. And I caught a brown trout in there one time. You better believe, man, I pulled that thing up and popped its gills and, you know, I mean, I ate it, but the...
I mean, the irony of all this is that most of the things we love are theoretically invasive. There's brown trout down the street from you in Montana because somebody put them there, you know? So I always get a little bit of chuckle out of that when I see these things, although in this case, we're at least dealing with true natives. Rio Grande's are true natives. The brook trout out here are true natives. But, you know, it's like this is an example of where planting ultimately was a bad deal. At the same time, you know, I'm sure there are other rivers in New Mexico that are loaded with rainbows and browns that people love, but they weren't there either. Somebody dumped them too. So it's always like, you know, a little like, haha, see? You
are rainbows in New Mexico? Are they like on the right side of that water? No. I mean like wild.
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know that for sure, but I mean, they're wild throughout the Rockies, and there's Rockies in New Mexico, are there not?
Yeah, but they're not wild on, like, this side of the Rockies because we're east of the Continental Divide here.
Right.
Like, and I'm listeners, I'm bad at geography. That's basically what I'm asking Joe about, who appears to be equally bad at geography.
No, you are west of the divide in Bozeman, are you not?
No.
No?
Listeners, well, again, whatever. Joe is also bad at geography.
I leave the East Coast and I forget that not every river flows north to south. Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, fascinating study. Really curious to see how that plays out in the long game.
Please enter your password. You have one unheard message.
You spot-burning son of a bitch. If you give away one more of my fishing holes by geotagging them on social media, I'm going to slash your tires.
End of message. Delete. Press 7. Save. Deleted.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land? Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
All right, so I hate to do it, but we have to talk about something that we'd call a major bummer, but take heart that it's like being used to avoid major tragedy. Washington yeah. State, after careful science-based consideration, has imposed major restrictions on a particularly beloved fishery. I'm going to read a real quick section from the official press release put out by the WDFW. In an effort to meet management objectives and provide necessary protection for dwindling wild steelhead populations, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife today announced a full closure to all sport fishing throughout the Washington coast and the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Dude, I know like there's some like steelhead dude like just cringing in my pronunciation of that, so I accept.
Well, it's either Fuca or Fuca
or Fuca.
When you well,
it's probably
I was,
not. Fuca.
I was like, I was like, he's gonna say Fuca.
We have to bleep those. No, we'll let.
Do
him
we bleep that? No, I think
we're gonna let him roll.
It's a proper noun.
Anyway, the full closure will take effect Tuesday, March 1st. So this happened on, what was that, Tuesday? Oh,
yes
because it says Tuesday, March 1st. I'm dumb. The closure follows the review of preliminary data that suggests the forecasted returns are likely coming back as low as 30% of what fishery managers expected, foreshadowing perhaps the lowest return ever recorded in some rivers. Based on historic return timing, most hatchery steelhead runs have ended, and the wild steelhead returns are more than one-third of the way complete. And this is like an inception quote, a quote inside a quote. Throughout our conversations with anglers and the broader coastal community, we've been upfront about our commitment to designing fisheries that meet our conservation objectives, said Kelly Cunningham, WDFW Fish Program Director. With this preliminary data in hand that now suggests coastal steelhead returns are significantly lower than we've expected, we need to take bold, swift actions for the future of these runs. Now, yeah. Now, this is tough, and there are multiple sides to what's going down here. Right away, people...
Yeah. I think we got to say, like West Side Steelheaders, heart goes out. But I mean, if this is what it's going to take to build back, I'm sure there are some people who agree with this. The same thing has been suggested on the Striper Coast. Like, how about we just not fish for them for a few years? So, I feel so bad for you guys, but maybe drastic measures,
Right away, people are going to be disappointed, and this is going to hurt a bunch of guides who make their livelihood pursuing these fish. There is no doubt about that. But here's the thing. At least for now, it appears it's short term, right?
Right.
The forest through the trees, man. The fact is steelhead have been declining for at least the last 70 years. A recent study titled Historical Records Reveal Changes to the Migration, Timing, and Abundance of Winter Steelhead in Olympic Peninsula Rivers, Washington State, USA, by John R. McMillan, Matthew R. Sloat, Martin Learman, and George Pess, discovered as much as a 50% decrease of returning steelhead in the OP. The study gets into a lot of hard to swallow facts, and much of the outlook is, you know, at least on the current trajectory, grim.
It's not good. Yeah. No. Yeah.
So historically, the runs used to begin in, and this is like a little background on all this, and this is something that I gleaned from the study, right? So historically, the runs used to begin in November, but the runs have been getting progressively later. A lot of folks like don't even get a jump on steelhead fishing until, you know, I think like January is when a lot of folks consider that season to be starting in earnest. The authors of the aforementioned study hypothesize that this is not so much the fish as a whole, like simply delaying their return to freshwater or like shifting run timing. Rather, what they think that we're witnessing is a shortened run, perhaps having lost the early returning steelhead in their entirety. So rather than
it makes sense because in no migratory fishery, generally speaking, do all the fish come at one time. Like you get this wave and then this wave. And so, I get what they're saying.
Yeah. So if there are, you know, to break it down like real quick, if there are three waves, right? One starting in November, one starting in December, and one starting in, you know, January, February, they're saying that the first and second waves are just like not happening.
Doesn't exist.
And it's not that all these fish have decided to move over to the later wave. It's that they no longer exist. Now, there's a lot to back this up. A historical ledger the authors discovered detailed runs from 1948 to 1960 that were significantly larger than what some scientists even estimated. This has an impact on how we interpret the runs we experience today. So we're working with a new data set. Up until fairly recently, the steelhead runs on the Olympic Peninsula were considered to be strong. However, with the new context provided by a larger, more complete data set, the level of decline has become pronounced. To put simply, there used to be far more steelhead than we thought, and we've lost a lot of them.
Yeah.
So anyway, all that's to say, while being like relatively recent in terms of, I guess, like the broad scope of a fisheries history, the steelhead have been sliding for longer than thought.
Yeah.
Now, to get a more like local boots on the ground take by someone who is intimately familiar with the OP and the steelhead fishery, I reached out to my buddy Lee Geist. Lee's a lifelong resident of the OP, as well as a member of this year's Coastal Steelhead Advisory Committee. And I was like, hey, man, do me a favor, give me a quote. And he said, the OP has...
If you have a moment where you're not depressed, please give me a call.
Yeah. If you want to come down from the roof. He said, the OP has been in steep decline and it's no secret. I think the way we determine in-season run size is not very reliable. So the slightest hint of being under escapement, and folks, for those who don't know, escapement is the number of salmon or steelhead or other anadromous fish that gets through the gauntlet of anglers, commercial fishermen, and predators to reach spawning grounds. So when Lee says under escapement, he's saying under objective spawning numbers, in essence. Anyway, he says that, I think the way that we determine in-season run size is not very reliable, so the slightest hint of being under escapement requires heavy-handed moves by the agency. I want to be fishing badly, but it's comforting to know that those fish will be unmolested in March for the first time in a long time. And that's a big deal. Right. And this is coming back to me. That's the end of Lee's quote. I know we all like to blame like the commercial boogeyman, but and we talked about this in our Madison River conversation a while back, pressure from recreational anglers in the guide community has a real impact. We'd like to think that like catch and release fishing is this harmless way to like, I don't know, like essentially play with a fish. But once it gets beyond a certain scale or like a, you know, a Gladwell tipping point, it changes fish's patterns and behaviors, including when it comes time to spawn. Lee, thank you for the quote. Joe, your thoughts?
Well, what you said is correct. You know, if you go back a few decades, we can talk about West Side Steel, compare that to East Coast Stripers for the guys out here. The bottom line is there were not as many people out recreationally fishing for those fish. Like in all fisheries, there has been an uptick in pressure. I don't care what it is. That's the age we live in. It's a social media thing. It's an internet thing. You know, so when you, you know, even to compare the two again, even though we're talking about these steelhead running these massive rivers, super big rivers, long rivers, right? They're still in this confined space, which makes them vulnerable, right? They're going to use certain passages to move up. Guys figure that out, you know, versus striper in the ocean. But even then, you look at something like spawning season here. Well, you know, if there's 3,000 boats in Raritan Bay on a Saturday where they're all spawning versus 200 boats 30 years ago or 100 boats 30 years ago, shit, yeah. Like, for anybody to say that, you know, recreational fishing for certain things is no longer a factor. In other words, there's always been this attitude of, like, commercial. Like, recreational guys, the government could let us do whatever we want and it's never going to have an impact. No, that's not true. Like, that's just, you know, false thinking. There are instances where I agree more or less. Like tuna is an example. I don't think there's enough people with the means to go tuna fishing with the right boat and the amount of money for that to make much of you know, as much of an impact as big commercial operations. So it varies, you know, little by little, depending on the what we're talking about. But I mean, once those steelhead get in a river, it's just another trout in the stream. So you think about your favorite trout stream. Forget about a migratory run. If that got pounded, you know, over and over again, and people were taking fish and harassing fish. Like you said, any fishery will adapt to that pressure and the fish will behave differently. It kind of, you know, I won't call him out by name, but we recently got a letter from a listener about his struggles on the Salmon River in Pulaski. That's East Side Steel, right? Mm. Manufactured fishery. Dude, having good fishing there is harder than it was 10 years ago. Oh, yeah. I don't care what anybody says. And that's some of that is because of some sort of pitfalls with runs and year classes. But okay, all those fish are still there. You can't tell me they're not adapting to pressure. They are getting harder to catch than they used to be. So I think as painful as this is now, I would bet the bulk of the devoted West Side Steel crew is like, you know, like Lee said, good. Give them a friggin' break for one season through March to just, you know, be completely left alone, unmolested, you know, no fighting. Because I'm not an expert, but I'm pretty sure the further these fish get up the system, the further away they get from the coast. They've been through dams and an onslaught of this and that and the other thing. You know, you catch them 7,500 miles up the system. Now you're also fighting a fish that's been through a lot of shit. So it's very reasonable to say that fish might not have as good of a chance to survive or get to where it needs to spawn. So ultimately, I do think this is a good thing, despite it being a bummer right now. If I was out there, I would be an advocate for this. I would say, good, you know, let's just do it. Yeah. So anyway, we're going to hear what Phil has to say, what conservation message he was more into this week. Since, you know, nobody can mount their steelhead on the West Coast, how about some tips on the best way to get that 7-inch native brookie from the Tenkara rod to a plaque over your mantle? So we're going to hear from Phil, and then we're going to go right to the Bent helpline and give you some thoughts on that.
I normally edit the show at home, but today I'm working from the office directly across from Hayden Samick, who not only tried to write my own fish news judgment jokes, but tried to declare himself the winner. Hayden, why do you deserve to win fish news this week?
Well, Phil, because I'm bigger than you.
And the winner this week is Hayden Samick.
What are you laughing at, Martini? You're not an idiot, huh? You're not a damn loony now, boy. You're a fisherman.
What's your emergency?
Okay, so today on the Bent Helpline, we have a question from Bradley Dalton. Now, I'm not sure if Brad was just interested in what we thought or he meant to have this as a submission, but hey, Brad, if you're listening, here's your answer, man. So his question was, guys, I'm pretty much a want-to-be angler and have never had a fish mounted, but since my understanding is that all fish mounts are plastic anyway, why the heck would someone want a plastic bath toy stuck on the wall? I sure wouldn't want to stare at a plastic deer face, but would love a monster buck in the man cave. These pictures are from Anderson University in South Carolina when I went to college, and these are real fish. Bradley has attached three images of skin mounts. Old fish, but real fish. If they used to do it this way, why not now? Thanks, Brad Dalton. South Carolina. So
Brad. There's yeah. Okay. Go ahead. So, what are you gonna say?
Well, to be honest, I started writing him back. In fact, I finished writing him back and then realized that the link to taxidermy would make this ideal for our makers themed Bent podcast we're having this week.
Not only would it do that, I'll add to that as we press on with the makers deal, there is a skin mount taxidermist out there that I absolutely want to have on that segment. Mm. So this is a good sort of lead into what we would talk about there. But I think there's no other way to start an answer to Brad other than Brad is extremely wrong on many counts. I'm not being rude. I'm just being honest. First of all, like to call replica taxidermy bathtub toy plastic is extremely false. And also to say that to hint that nobody does skin mounts anymore is also very false. There are so many different options these days if you want to fish on your wall. And in the room I'm sitting in, I have all of them, so I can speak to this.
Okay, so the way that I want to answer this, Joe, is I want to do like you have a soft spot for skin mounts. Yes.
I do. But
like not like to the exclusion of other things, but you like them.
I do. Yes.
Now, I don't dislike skin mounts, but I am a proponent of the fiberglass mounts, and we'll get to that in a minute. So, why don't you start off talking about the skin mounts and then I'll pick it up with the fiberglass replicas. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean I can't do that exclusively because it's not a like you're the replica guy and I'm the skin mount guy. It's totally case by case. And I am certainly a huge fan of replica mounts. That's mostly what I have. But I think, first of all, they're fiberglass, not plastic. That's neither here nor there. The bad reputation that replica mounts get, right, is from the fact that you can get them from a bunch of different sources. And I am here to tell you, if you catch a fish, or for that matter, shoot an animal, a deer, elk, whatever, and like you really want that thing on your wall, that is not the time to pinch pennies. Like there is no thing as budget taxidermy. I don't care whether it's skin or replica or what. So yeah, I mean, just to use, I'm looking right now, the first bass, striped bass I ever caught that was broke 40 pounds, I had a replica mount made. I had that made by a small-time operator in Philadelphia who was known throughout the area for his detailed paintwork. So even though it was a replica, right, his paintwork is phenomenal.
But I love how I teed you up to talk about skin mounts, and instead you've just like totally trodden over all the replica arguments I'm about to make.
But I'm getting – well, that's too bad. Okay, you let me speak first. Okay. This is the risk you take.
Always a mistake. Always
but
a
I,
mistake.
But I can't talk skin without explaining this. Uh-huh. So, it's a beautiful replica mount. Likewise, you catch a 40-pound bass and you only want to spend a couple $100, you can get a mount out of Florida. There are like King Sailfish mounts, Gray's Taxidermy. They make exquisite replica mounts. There are clearinghouses that'll knock out a 40-pound striper for you for not very much money. and it is going to look like dog shit. Like the paint job is not going to be good. It's going to look like shit. So, as with everything, skin or not, you have to pick who you're working with. And the more you pay, the more you're going to like it for the most part. But to look at something like a 40-pound striper as an example, one 40-pound striper looks like the next 40-pound striper, looks like the next one, like the next one, like the next one. There's not a whole lot of unique characteristics of that fish. So therefore, if that's the case, you're talking about a dolphin you caught on vacation or a sailfish or a striper, huge proponent, I mean, if you want to, of letting the sailfish go, or even if you take the mahi home to eat, there's no reason you can't have your fish tacos, but need to save that for a skin mount. Now, likewise, there have been instances where I just felt skin was the option I would be happier with in the long run. Prime example, I have a silver salmon here on my wall. I'm not going to get into the whole story because it's very long, but there was a very specific reason why I chose to have that fish mounted. It was kind of like a hell week, and that was the closer after a lot of hard work. It's a particularly big fish, and I caught it in Ninilchik, Alaska. And I couldn't get my head around the idea of having some dude in Florida who may or may not have ever seen or held a silver salmon painting up a silver salmon for me. So in that instance, I had a skin mount made, and I had it made at a taxidermist in Ninilchik. I paid a shitload of money for it. But that was one where I'm like, I want the real fish there. I want the skin from the salmon that I caught on my wall. So I am certainly not opposed to skin mount taxidermy. But for me, there has to be, I think, the right reason. Like I know guys in the striper world who don't kill any stripers. But if they catch their 50 or 60 pound dream fish, A, there might not be the right mold for that out there. It's like they would sacrifice that one that they've been trying for so long to have the real skin on their wall. So it's totally case by case.
Right. Okay. So to bring it back to the question, people do in fact still skin mount fish. Now his question about why you would want a plastic bath toy, as he describes it, bro, you just haven't seen good ones, I guess. I don't really know what to tell you, but so here's the reality. Like those replica mounts, a replica mount is a fiberglass mold of a certain fish, and they come in. They can come in size. I believe you can custom order like a bunch of sizes because you take those measurements. You take the length and the girth.
Yeah, you take length and girth, and if anybody's thinking about doing this, shoot tons of video, tons of pictures. Like do a video pan. The more detail they have, the better. For the most part, these days, a fish will already have sacrificed its life to make the mold that you need. However, if you did catch something that's like a world record, or you can also, send that in to be molded, sometimes they'll even cut you a break because now the outfit is now gaining a mold from your fish. So on the rare occasion, it can be completely custom. For the most part, no fish has to die. There's a mold already there. One already sacrificed itself. Yeah.
Right. So, okay. So the deal here is that, as Joe was alluding to, man, you can take photographs of the fish that you wish to have on your wall, and then you can release that fish.
Mm-hmm.
You send them in the pictures. They look at it. They paint the fish in the exact same way.
The good places do. That's what separates the difference. Yeah.
Yeah. Like they'll go in with an airbrush and they'll do it specifically. You're not just saying like, I want a striper of this size. And they're going like, great, we have three of them on the shelf here. And they're sending you one that does not have the same markings. They're going through with all the care of how a taxidermist would paint a skin mounted fish anyway.
Yep.
Because that's the other thing. When you get a skin mounted fish, it's not like mounting like a deer or a turkey where like the fur or the plumage retains its color. The skin just becomes like gray. You know what I mean? It just becomes whatever detailless color a piece of fish skin turns into in the taxidermy process. And they have to paint it anyway. Really what you're paying for is the attention to detail and like the scale articulation. But by the time they put the finish on it that allows that thing to stay in in a stable form, they've lacquered over those scales anyway. It's not like you can get your finger under there.
Yeah. Well, and I would venture to guess, I sort of know, but I'd love to talk to an expert. Skin mounted taxidermy has come a long way. Like, so I collect old skin mounts I find at flea markets and stuff. And as Brad pointed out, you see these old ones, they look like trash. Well, why is that? They didn't have the technology back in the day to get all the oil out of the head and out of that fish. And over time, it will degrade. Mm-hmm. I think that's gotten a lot better with good skin mount guys. Most of the time, they never use the fish's real head. So the skin is real. Often the fins, like the pec fins and things, are plastic and added later. And they use a head so that lasts a lot longer. That was the case with my salmon. Still looks great all these years later. I got a walleye over here. Its head is like dripping onto my floor.
Right, right.
You know?
And so, and the other thing with it too is that when you send a fish to the taxidermist, much to the dismay of the breeze, you do not get that fish back.
Like, no, you don't get to eat it. No,
you don't get to eat it. So really, when you take everything into account, you're basically killing a fish for no significant gain. And oftentimes, the fish that you want to kill is like a good breeding fish. Basically, I don't know if folks know this, but I'm pretty sure it's whales and humans are the only things that live beyond their like reproductive capabilities, right? So any large fish that you're killing probably has the potential to be one of the best breeders in that like, you know, stock of fish.
So yeah, with a lot of things, not all, but you're right. Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say that the other thing that you like run into is like tarpon, right? Tarpon famously are not a good fish to eat. In fact, like there's that, I don't know if it's like a rumor or like an actual thing where they tried to make cat food out of them in the 50s, but even the cats wouldn't eat them.
Yeah, I think it's urban legend, but I've heard that.
Yeah. So it's like, just why do it, man? There's just like no point in it. And what the other thing is, you're going to have something that like retains its shape and structure like forever. I'm not aware of any instance where like a fiberglass fish replica has turned to shit.
No, they won't.
A million skin mounts that have done exactly that.
And I'll throw one more out before we get off of this. Actually, I told you I have a mixed media in terms of fish on my wall here. I have become the biggest freaking proponent of having your fish wood carved. Now the trick to this though is commissioning a really exceptional carver, because if the guy is not like top notch, then they can look more like bath toys than the replica. But Rich Metzger, shout out to him. He's local, Perkasie, Pennsylvania. He'd be another great guy to have on as a maker. He has done two fish for me, a snakehead and a tiger trout. And it's not cheap, but like we said, if you want it done right, it's not going to be cheap. The beauty of wood carving, if the guy is really good, it's a one of a kind. So if you order a 40-pound striped bass from a replica house, you are getting the same shape, size, fish, same orientation as a million other people that caught a 40-pound striped bass. You get your trout or largemouth or whatever wood carved, you can have that sucker facing down, up, sideways, tail moving, body half bent, anything you want. It is the ultimate customization of a mount. And Rich is so good, he actually carved a largemouth that was on the cover of Field and Stream for us back in the day. That's my deal. Like, I think that's even better than replica.
I think that might be what I opt for next time, should the finances allow it. So, Brad, in order to quickly summate our answer, number one, you can still get a skin fish mount. Number two, you are not correct in your assessment of quality replica mounts, man. They're good. The fish doesn't have to die. You're going to have it for longer, and you know, you'll probably be extremely happy with it should you choose to go that route in the future. And finally, Joe, recommendation for wood carvers. That is I think that's a really solid way to go, man.
Yes, it is. Like I said, though, you got to do your research and find the right guy. The guy I used, man, some of his work, they look more realistic than the skin and fiberglass mounts I have. Mm-hmm. Hey, if you've got a question for the Bent Helpline we can help you answer, do please send that to bent@themeateater.com, and maybe we'll rap about your problems and concerns right here on the Bent Helpline. So that's it for this week. Hopefully we've inspired you to get out and make something, whether that's a sandwich, a memory, or a payment on your student loans.
No, man, rebel. No payments on student loans. don't do that. You'll get in financial trouble. Don't come to me for financial advice. Thanks again to Ryan Ebert for joining us. And don't forget, we love it when you tell us which fishy dive bars we should join you at. So keep those bar nominations, sale bin items, awkward photos, questions, and whatever else you want to send coming to bent@themeateater.com.
Yeah, keep using those Degenerate Angler and Bent podcast hashtags, especially if you post something that you made, whether that was in a fine craftsman shop setting or while completely intoxicated in the cheapest motel room on the river.
Yes, and please don't inundate us with every fly you've ever tied. You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.